thriving in extreme conditions deep below the surface of other planets, like Mars. And finally, if early life on our planet was able to soldier on despite the chaos of the late heavy bombardment, well, that's quite a testament to life's tenacity. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear with help from Lisa Pratt in geology. I'm Don Glass.
It's 2:41. In sports, Major League Baseball's postseason is underway this afternoon in Philadelphia, where the East champion Phillies are taking on the wild card winning Colorado Rockies. In the top of the fourth, no score. The St. Louis Cardinals hand the ball to Chris Carpenter for tonight's playoff opener against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Randy Wolf will start for the Dodgers. The Cards won 5 of 7 from Los Angeles during the regular season. It's a night off for both the Chicago Blackhawks and St. Louis Blues. The Blackhawks are on the road in Detroit tomorrow night, while the Blues are home against Atlanta. The Chicago Bulls have edged the Utah Jazz for a preseason victory in London. James Johnson sank a fadeaway jump shot from the baseline at the buzzer yesterday to give the Bulls a 102-101 win. French anti-doping authorities say that retests of blood samples from 17 riders at the 2008 Tour de France have all come back clean. Pierre Baudry, head of the anti-doping agency known as AFLD, quote, rejoiced that the tests all came back negative. He declined to identify the cyclists involved. Well, sports commentator Frank DeFord says it's been a strange week in the world of sports. Here he hits the highlights and the lowlights.
My gracious, but this has been a difficult time for us sports troubadours. We do better with simple games, with the tic-tac-toe, offensive and defensive, X's and O's, as opposed to the X's and O's that refer to past marital tense and current romantic joy. I mean, hardly had I begun to digest the news that Lamar Odom of the NBA had married Khloe Kardashian of reality show fame. Oh, then comes word that Chris Evert and Greg Norman, America's senior sweethearts, had broken up potential exes-to-be. Then poor Ted Williams' frozen head returned to the news, grisly and grimly. Poor Chicago, odds-on favorite to host the games in 2016, is thrown out on its keister by the International Olympic Committee, a cabal that loathes the United States only slightly less than do the Taliban and Roman Polanski. But let us return to matters of the heart. Tell me now, weren't we all convinced that Chrissy and the Shark were the perfect couple for the 19th hole of life? Indeed, because the rich and handsome Shark had actually become that rare, rich, handsome 50-something male celebrity to actually marry someone of his own generation, his popularity amongst mature women soared. But as we were Cupid's acolytes rooting for Greg and Chrissy, we forgot that marriages between two athletes seldom hold up. A nation now turns its sentimental eyes toward Andre and Steffi. The Odom-Kardashian union poses a more intriguing question, though. Can the marriage of an athlete and a reality show star succeed? That's something so new the jury isn't even out yet. So whirlwind was the romance between the L.A. Laker and the reality lifer that we are only now assembling the voir dire in this matter. As for that quadrennial global reality show, Chicago's abject rejection is no one's fault here. Not the president's, not Oprah's. For once, we can't even blame the Cubs. Rather, the greasy antics of the International Olympic Committee make Chicago's own fabled politics look, by comparison, like Periclean Athens. The IOC members still hold it against the United States that the Atlanta Olympics were so tacky and that the Salt Lake City Olympics highlighted the IOC corruption that has so often attended the selection of host cities. Forget it, America. Any U.S. metropolis that may be pondering a bid for the 2020 Olympics would be more wisely advised to petition St. Augustine to become the designated city of God. It would have a much better chance to earn that distinction.
Sports commentator Frank DeFord.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the M2 on Neal mixed-use project in downtown Champaign, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:46. The price of gold hit an all-time high yesterday of $1,043 per ounce. One thing that's pushing the price of this precious metal so high is uncertainty about the dollar and its future role in the global economy. NPR's John Idstey reports.
While gold set a new record in dollar terms, the peak was not a record in other major currencies. Gold has risen in dollar terms recently because the U.S. currency's value has steadily fallen as the financial crisis has abated. Back during the depths of the crisis, the dollar strengthened as investors around the world rushed to the safety of U.S. government securities. But now investors are focusing on the dollar's shortcomings. Many fear that massive U.S. government spending to fight the recession will ultimately spark inflation and erode the dollar's value. Also, talk of replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency has investors worried. Those worries were inflamed by a report yesterday in the British newspaper The Independent, which said oil producers were in secret meetings to end the practice of pricing oil in dollars. The story was immediately denied by top officials from big oil producers Saudi Arabia and Russia. While some analysts predict gold may rocket to more than $2,000 an ounce, others are nervous about its current lofty levels. They note that demand for gold jewelry is down about 15% because of economic weakness worldwide. But the desire of fund managers to hold some gold in their portfolios as a hedge against inflation could keep its price high. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
People concerned about energy production and the environment are becoming more and more interested in producing their own energy. Stephanie Hemphill reports on an effort to harvest the wind and other natural resources to power a community.
Three students are getting ready to climb a TV tower on Moose Mountain on the north shore of Lake Superior. They'll put up three anemometers, little cups that spin in the wind and measure how fast it's blowing. As they deploy their climbing equipment, their professor, Mike Meju, keeps asking if they have enough safety gear. He seems a little anxious.
Two of them are mountain climbers. They seem to think this will be no big deal.
Meju teaches at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He's been measuring the wind on the high ridge that runs along the Lake Superior shoreline.
If you look at the statewide wind maps, the current maps, they don't give us much credit for having any wind along the north shore of Lake Superior. But Grand Portage was really interested in wind, and they did some monitoring, and we helped them. This was years ago.
That's the Grand Portage Band of Ojibwe Indians. Meju got a grant to install monitoring equipment up and down the Lake Superior shoreline.
And we found 15 to 20 mile an hour sort of average wind speeds at the sites.
That's about the same as the best wind sites in Iowa, where huge wind farms spread across the landscape. Meju doesn't advocate a big wind farm here. Instead, the idea is to put up one windmill for each community along the shore. One big turbine could supply roughly half the electricity each town uses. He knows some people are nervous about this. The north shore of Lake Superior is beautiful, and no one wants to ruin the scenery. It's also an important route for migrating birds. There's concern that birds could fly into the spinning blades. A separate group of researchers is studying the migration routes.
Are they flying close to the lake? Are they flying right along the peaks? Are they flying just inland of the peak or just lakeside of the, you know, where are they flying? So hopefully when we ultimately pick a wind site, we'll stay away, you know, from the birds.
If a wind tower is ever built here, the power would go to the town of Grand Marais, Minnesota, 20 miles north, and it would fit in with other projects local folks are working on to become more energy self-sufficient. Buck Benson owns the local hardware store. He says he and his friends, George and Lonnie, hatched the idea while they were fishing.
You know, we're grumbling about all this stuff. What can we really do? And when we came back home, George kept prodding us, you know what we talked about. So we formed a little group, and I think we've done good work since we've started this organization.
The group has been researching various ideas about how to produce energy locally. One team is pursuing that windmill idea we heard about. Another project is a little closer to being built. They want to burn the wood chips from a local sawmill in a central heating system for the town. The chips would come from Hedstrom Lumber Mill. Howard Hedstrom says the mill sells bark chipped off the trees, but he has to haul it miles away to sell it.
By the time you pay the freight, there's not much left, and if it could be used locally, why not use it locally and save all that transportation cost?
The city of Grand Marais has applied for a federal grant to pay for half the cost of the boiler. Communities across the country are looking to use what they've got around them instead of importing energy from a big coal or nuclear plant miles away. It helps keep money close to home, and it could be better for the earth. For the Environment Report, I'm Stephanie Hemphill.
Prisons probably aren't the first place you'd expect to find organic gardens or beekeeping, but in some prisons in western Washington, inmates are being taught new skills in getting involved in conservation work. As Sadie Babbitts found out, inmates say they're restoring their own lives by helping save native prairie and growing veggies.
Stafford Creek Prison would feel like a college campus if it weren't for the series of heavy metal gates and the barbed wire. 2,000 prisoners are held at this medium security facility. A select group of them who've been cleared on good behavior get to work in what's called the hub. It doesn't sound too exciting until you spot the greenhouses. Inside the largest greenhouse, there are hundreds of yellow plastic tubes. Three inmates are filling these tubes with dirt. They're planting seeds to help restore native grasses. Toby Earhart is one of these prisoners.
I don't know if what we're doing will make a huge impact on the world, but I know it's making a huge impact on this project. I know that it's going to change the face of the prairies in western Washington.
This is the project's first year. The goal is to grow 200,000 plants for the prairies. It's getting hot and muggy inside the greenhouse, so inmate Jeff Harrigan heads outside. He leans against the greenhouse as he talks about what it's like to grow these plants.
It's just been a learning experience for me because I've never done nothing like this on the streets.
Harrigan has been in and out of prison 6 different times.
I've just learned that doing other things other than stealing and doing drugs and all that just makes you feel better about yourself. I feel like I'm putting something back. Well, I mean, something that's actually saving something. Because it's saving the butterflies and stuff from what they told us.
Harrigan says he's never planted anything until coming to Stafford Creek.
And actually, it's kind of cool because since I've been here, I asked my girlfriend something I've never asked her for, what her favorite flowers were, just because I had started planting flowers.
Turns out marigolds and hens and chicks are her favorites. Two plants, Harrigan says, that can be found around the prison. When he's not planting native grasses, Harrigan works in the prison's vegetable garden.
Right here, this is stuff that we've planted. There's onions, there's radishes, there's beans.
So far, he's helped harvest peas, garlic, and 200 pounds of zucchini. The kitchen staff took that squash and turned it into zucchini bread for the inmates. Harrigan talks about how hard it was for him to keep a job when he was outside prison. Drugs always got in the way. Now he says he feels like he's doing something that matters, and he hopes this experience in prison will help him when he gets out.
Actually, it's teaching me better work ethics, too, because I've never really had them out there. You know, I've never really kept a job, probably because I didn't like most of my jobs, you know.
Harrigan says he does like gardening. He says he now knows how to germinate seeds and how to get plants to take off. Skills, he says, that could help him get a job once he's back out in society.
At least for a person like me that wants to still feel that, I'm still human and I'm still got good parts in me, you know. This stuff kind of brings you back to reality.
He's got another year and a half to go before he's free. Harrigan says he's already told his girlfriend when he does get out, they have to plant a garden. It's something he hopes will keep him from coming back to Stafford Creek. For the Environment Report, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Theater Council, presenting An Evening with David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Friday, October 16th at 8 p.m. Ticket information at 217-356-9063.
It's 5 minutes before 3 o'clock. Coming up at 3 today, The World from PRI. On the program today, Armenia's president is about to make history by signing an agreement with Turkey. It would open up their shared border and end nearly a century of hostility. The deal makes economic sense for Armenia, but many Armenians living abroad feel it absolves Turkey of responsibility for what they call the genocide of 1915. That story in the day's news coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock. On Sunday afternoon, this Sunday afternoon at 5, we hope you'll join us for a live broadcast of Keeping the Faith. Each week, host Steve Shoemaker and his guests explore issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. This week, guest host Don Nolan talks with Zachariah Ozovic about the Muslim Intercultural Friendship Foundation. That's Keeping the Faith, Sunday afternoon at 5, here on AM 580.
Earth and Sky.
When you look at the total array of water problems within California, this one problem sits right at the top.
You're listening to Jeff Mount of the University of California, Davis. He's speaking about the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta in Northern California.
This delta is basically the fresh water supply for 25 million Californians and at least 3 million acres of irrigated agriculture, making it really the most significant hub in California's water supply system.
This area was originally a large freshwater marsh. A system of levees converted the area into a populous agricultural region. Mount said over time the levees have weakened and the ecosystem has declined.
Today we are in a full-blown crisis. The ecosystems have degraded so much there that you're losing native species. The levee system itself is so fragile that it is on the verge of collapse. We're staring down the barrel of climate change within this system, which will exacerbate the problems within this delta. And we have no political consensus on what to do about it.
Mount said California's future as a food producer for the rest of the U.S. is tied to its water. The state will have to make difficult choices to restore the delta.
I remain optimistic because I think we have the tools, we have the resources.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
2 minutes before 3 o'clock, a flash flood watch has been posted for portions of central into southern Illinois. It goes into effect tomorrow morning, and it runs through Friday morning. This afternoon's forecast for Illinois and